as I read it, the final case on the docket for today is Commonwealth Virginia and William Austin Clark.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Brad Lindsay with the Fairfax County Public Defender's Office, and on behalf of Mr. William Clark. At the outset, I would ask for 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Clark asked this court to vacate his conviction and dismiss Mr. Clark's conviction, or in the alternative, to vacate his conviction and remand back to the trial court. I'll address assignment of error number one in my brief first for the court. In this case, the trial court erred because it forced Mr. Clark to choose between two trial rights. One, the constitutional right to have a jury properly instructed in the law, and two, the right to have only admissible evidence submitted at trial in compliance with Virginia rules of evidence. The choice is made very clear, and I point this court to the appendix, page 163, where the court states, you're going to withdraw the instruction about an assault necessarily includes the intent to do bodily harm. Mr. Pettit responds, the court is ruling that if we request that instruction, court then responds that I'm going to reopen hepatitis C. This was not a strategic choice, this was an impermissible choice. And the reason is that there are a few things that are guaranteed to a criminal defendant at a trial. Those two things that are guaranteed is the constitutional right to a fair and impartial jury, which also requires that jury be necessarily and properly instructed on all areas of the law relevant to the case.
And also, counsel, I appreciate where you're going with this, but as I was looking at it, it struck me that this was basically a determination of strategy. Essentially, the Commonwealth needed to make the necessary elements of its case. And in the context of what was being argued, intent to do bodily harm became a big issue. And it seems to me, and I used to do criminal defense work, I'm making a strategic choice. Okay, do I want this information of the hepatitis C to come out about my client in any context because it might contaminate my whole theory of the case? Does that get me the privilege of the Commonwealth being prevented from presenting part of its theory of the case by having hepatitis C and spitting at the officer that necessarily caused the, theoretically provide the intent necessary to justify the crime that they're trying to prosecute? Did that make any sense to you?
I believe so, Your Honor, and if I don't answer Your Honor's question, please interrupt me, but I believe the difference is, and I would point to the court that the Bordenkircher v. Hayes case, the U.S. Supreme Court case, where the defendant was charged with and indicted with utter. At arraignment, counsel was present, retained counsel for the defendant, and also the Commonwealth attorney, or the prosecutor. An offer was made by the prosecutor, plead guilty now, agree to a 5-year sentence, or we're going to re-indict or re-up the ante and charge you with under the habitual offender statute, or habitual recidivist statute. And at that time, the plea offer was rejected, the defendant went to trial, and then of course was convicted and given a life sentence. The court said that this was in the sound discretion of the Commonwealth attorney to do that because it was pre-trial, the Commonwealth chooses its charges and can go forward. The difference between that case and this case is that it's not one of strategy. Mr. Clark does not have to choose which right to assert at trial. He gets both. He gets both the right to tell the jury and inform the jury of all elements necessary to find him guilty of the crime, and he also gets the right to only have admissible evidence presented against him. In this case, he had to choose against a prior court ruling that kept that evidence out and then allowed it back in. I would point the court to Battle v. Commonwealth, which I also cited in my brief.
But isn't that consistent with any time a defendant makes a strategic call? I'll give you an example. Suppose a defendant makes an incriminatory statement when he's arrested, says, I did it. And you make a motion to suppress that evidence, claiming that it was taken in violation of the Fifth Amendment Miranda. And you win on the motion to suppress. And you say, okay, that's great. And then the defendant decides he wants to take a stand. What happens to that motion to suppress?
Then the statement is allowed to come in to impeach the defendant's credibility in terms of what he said at the stand. And I would agree with the court in that regard, that's different because the law allows that. I do not believe the law allows what happened in this case for that specific purpose. Evidence was deemed inadmissible. Commonwealth had already closed its case. It's much more akin to the Battle case where the Commonwealth threatened after the defendant won a pretrial motion to suppress evidence in violation of a discovery order that they're going to re-up the charges and indict on a possession with intent to distribute as opposed to a simple possession. The court then gave the defendant the choice, well, you either get the null pros and you get to keep the evidence out, or the Commonwealth's going to null pros and bring the charge back and up the ante. And the court found that that was impermissible because it's requiring the defendant to choose between rights. And I would point to the language in U.S. v. Gooden, 457 U.S. 368 from the Supreme Court of the United States, that it violates the basic principle that certainly a defendant may be penalized for violating the law. However, he just as certainly may not be punished for exercising and protecting a statutory or constitutional right, which is exactly what Mr. Clark was doing in this case. He had a pretrial motion, kept the evidence out, the evidence was deemed irrelevant, and then the court required Mr. Clark to choose between instructing the jury properly on the case or essentially waiving contesting the element of the case, the element of intent to do bodily harm. And the court simply cannot make this determination. I would move further to tell the court that the trial court
had... But if we look at it in the context that you discussed, and it's an interesting context, when we're dealing with constitutional implications, obviously we're going to exact more scrutiny on what's going on. But here we're not really talking about something in the nature of a constitutional concern. We're talking more about it in an evidentiary concern because the motion that was made here was not a motion to suppress. It was a motion in limine. And a motion in limine, by its very nature, is a motion to limit the presentation of evidence because of certain circumstances. However, there are exceptions to when those circumstances no longer apply. Typically, and when you have a case involving a defendant who has an MO or an identity or something, the defense attorney who's on his game or her game is going to file a motion in limine to keep out prior bad acts because that's going to be disadvantageous to his or her client. But if certain things happen during the course of the trial, a motion in limine that might have previously been granted becomes fair game if the evidence supports a theory of liability that wasn't previously raised in the context of the motion in limine.
And I would submit to the court that there is no evidence that supports the already deemed inadmissible evidence as now relevant. The trial court mentions that hepatitis C may be relevant. However, it makes no factual finding. And I think that's where the trial court's own prejudice were getting in the way of his ruling. There is no evidence presented, proffered, or otherwise by the Commonwealth attorney of what Mr. Clark's status as hepatitis C has anything to do with whether or not he intended to commit bodily harm. There's no evidence that a person with hepatitis C can transmit that disease by spitting or otherwise projecting water out from one's mouth onto another person. Then it becomes, there was no evidence that Mr. Clark, other than a statement, I am hepatitis C positive, was actually hepatitis C positive. There was no medical or otherwise evidence presented by the Commonwealth that would suggest or otherwise make the fact that Mr. Clark may or may not have been hepatitis C positive relevant. And whatever tenuous relevance there would be would certainly be negated by the overwhelming prejudicial effect that the jury would hear that this gentleman who is alleged to have spit on someone has hepatitis C, because then the jury is allowed to curtail back to its own possible prejudices or fears that anyone who has hepatitis C, or as an analogy, anyone who has AIDS, if they project any type of liquid onto another from their body, they must have been meaning to do this. And that was simply not the case. The Commonwealth provided no evidence down below of any tenuous relationship between Mr. Clark being hepatitis C positive and that somehow necessarily creating the intent to do bodily harm. I would also point to the court that the court in this case had an affirmative duty to instruct the jury on the principles of law applicable to the case and ensure the instructions are a correct statement of law. As I pointed out in my brief, Davis v. Commonwealth is clear that one cannot be convicted of an assault and battery without the intention to do bodily harm. The Commonwealth, in its response to my brief, goes at pains to say that intent to do bodily harm is not an element of a battery. I would point the court to the statute, 18257, specifically says subsection C, which is what Mr. Clark was charged under, that anyone can be found guilty of assault or assault and battery. There is no such thing as just a battery theory alone under subsection C. And I would point the court directly below C to D and E, which states that anyone who is a health employee, which is E, and D is anyone involved in a school system, can be, if they are assaulted in their capacity, if they are battered, that is all D and E say. Nothing about assault or assault and battery. It specifically says, and if I could use the language, in addition, this is subsection D from 18257, in addition, if any person commits a battery against another, it does not say anything, whereas subsection C says, if in addition, if any person commits an assault or an assault and battery.
Let me ask you this, counsel, and I'm sure Ms. Johnson is going to mention this when she stands up. Where is it that you would contend that you preserve this particular issue?
Yes, Your Honor. I would first point to the objection made on page of the appendix, page 160 to 164. Mr. Pettick does state, I object to that, Your Honor. This is an assault and battery. The court says I'm reopening hepatitis C. And then page 164 again says, but note my objection, and we will withdraw the instruction based on the court's ruling. And that's where the choice becomes very clear. The court says you're going to withdraw it, or you're going to accept my, you can't do both. You can't voluntarily withdraw it, but then note my exception. So we would argue, Your Honor, that it is preserved. However, even if this court finds that it's not preserved, Your Honor, we would argue that it's preserved under the ends of justice exception. Court's brief indulgence. And Your Honor, as I pointed out in my brief, the ends of justice exception can be obtained when a review of the record, there is an error by the trial court that is clear, substantial, and material. This court has applied this exception when a proper description of the elements of the offense was vital to ensure a fair trial. That's from Campbell v. Commonwealth. That's from this court. And this court reiterated that same notion when it stated that the Supreme Court of Virginia has unequivocally reaffirmed the principle that when a principle of law is vital to a defendant in a criminal case, a trial court has the affirmative duty to properly instruct a jury about the matter. And that this principle applies even without a stated objection. I point the court to specifically to Campbell. Campbell involved an intent to defraud. That intent element was left completely out of the jury instructions, and the court submitted the case to the jury without ever telling the jury that they necessarily, in order to find this defendant guilty, required to do an intent to defraud. And the court stated that even though there was no stated objection by trial counsel, this court, the trial court, had an affirmative duty to inform the jury of the proper instructions, which would be the intent to defraud. Okay.
We'll save the rest of your time for rebuttal, sir. Ms. Johnson.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'm Victoria Johnson, and I represent the Commonwealth. This conviction should be affirmed because the appellant's claims are not supported by the record. I would ask the court to look at the motion in limine, which was attached to my brief as an addendum, particularly at addendum pages 9 through 11. At that point, the Commonwealth stated in answer to the trial court's question that it was proceeding on a battery-only theory. The defendant did not object to that at all. And based on that statement by the Commonwealth, the trial court concluded that evidence of hepatitis C and any evidence of the intent to do bodily harm was not relevant to the prosecution. Because there was no objection at that time, the entire trial proceeded on that theory, on a battery-only theory.
Offensive touching theory.
Offensive touching.
Okay.
Commonwealth and the court and defense counsel pulled out the jury instructions, read the model jury instructions. The court was extremely clear at that point that it was not reaching the defendant's objection that the hepatitis C evidence was overly prejudicial, that its prejudicial value outweighed its probative value, but instead that it was granting the motion in limine on relevance grounds because the Commonwealth was not required to prove the intent to do bodily harm. There was no objection at that point. In fact, the trial proceeded until the jury instruction stage with that understanding. It was only at the jury instruction stage that the defense raised the assault definition jury instructions and sought jury instructions there. At that point, the court, and I think it's fair to read the record with, you know, some ire, perhaps, from the court. At that point, the court said, no, 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 we have been proceeding all along on this battery theory. Don't you all understand what the elements of the offense are? It is only the offense of touch that is purposeful, done in an angry, vengeful manner.
Without a requirement of proving any element of intent.
Without the requirement of any element of intent, other than that it be an intentional touching.
Yeah,
not the intent to do bodily harm. Mm-hmm. At no point did the defense proffer Davis v. Commonwealth, this case from 1928 upon which it now relies, and I didn't explicitly raise 5A18 as to that issue on my brief. To the extent I may do so, I would like to do so now. Furthermore, the battery is considered, and assault and battery and assault are all considered common law crimes in Virginia. The statute 18257C only sets out the punishment. We look towards the common law for the definition of the elements of the offense. This court has applied the touching only theory many times in assault and battery cases. And those cases are cited in my brief. It is Gant v. Commonwealth from 1998, Perkins in 2000. In the Supreme Court of Virginia, Lynch in 1921, Crosswhite v. Barnes in 1924, unpublished cases from this court, Bowser and May in 2004. And of course, as we know, the General Assembly is charged with knowing about these appellate decisions. If the General Assembly had wanted to, you know, in any way amend the statute so as to make it more clear, make the language more clear as to what was required, it certainly could have. I submit to the court that because there was never any objection to the battery, that has not been to the Commonwealth proceeding on a battery theory, that has not been assigned error. While it's not technically a law of the case theory, it is certainly very close to that. The court was proceeding on the battery theory.
Is it your position, ma'am, then, that the jury was adequately instructed on the crime of battery then, and that the proposed instructions by the defendant were unnecessary under the theory of the case?
Yes, Your Honor. That is my position. And therefore, there is no error by the trial court. Should this court find that there is error, however, I would submit that it is harmless error. There are a number of cases that I cited in my brief from this court recognizing harmless error in similar situations. The most helpful one is Kill versus Commonwealth. There, the defendant's theory was that he had no actual knowledge that he had been in a car accident, and this was leaving the scene of an accident conviction. And people had been killed during the accident. He claimed that he just had no idea that this had happened. And through some error, the jury was never instructed on the actual knowledge issue. The court found that the evidence was so overwhelming that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Kill had actual knowledge.
Where is that overwhelming evidence here?
Here, the court has said, this court has said in Parrish, that the unlawful intent, the intent to do bodily harm, may be imputed as a matter of law if the battery was done in a rude, insolent manner. That's Parrish v. Commonwealth, which is cited in my brief. Here, there was overwhelming evidence that this act of spitting in the officer's face was done in an intentional manner, which was the only issue at the trial court. The defense said that in closing argument at Appendix 204. So the only issue in the case was whether this was an intentional act. There was overwhelming evidence that it was intentional. There were, I believe, 4 eyewitnesses, including the victim, that said that the defendant asked for another drink of water, reared back in his chair in his restraint seat, and there was room behind his head so that he could do that. Reared back, gathered up that liquid, and spewed it forcefully at the officer. He laughed afterwards. He engaged in some obscenities. He later told the deputy that if he'd known that he was a shiftlet, he wouldn't have spat at him because he's related to some shiftlets. He also, previous to spitting on the deputy, he had threatened to injure the deputy. He said, as soon as I get these shackles off, I'm going to kick your teeth in. He had engaged in disruptive and rude and violent behavior all during the morning prior to the spitting. All that evidence was before the jury. That's overwhelming evidence of an intentional act done in a rude, insolent and vengeful manner. So that overwhelming evidence is there. Furthermore, Your Honor, while the appellant points to pages 160 to 64 in the brief, or pardon me, in the appendix is where he preserved the argument, you know, I would also look at page 165, where the public defender states, we will withdraw the jury instruction.
Well, I think what would be suggested by your opponent colleague is that he was forced into a dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to call it a Hobson's choice because people don't really understand what a Hobson's choice is. It's different. It's a
choice that is no choice.
Right. He's got a dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
He's either got to give up his theory of defense or allow this evidence to come in regarding hepatitis C, which could, in his view, contaminate the entire proceeding and cause a fact finder to infer all kinds of things which could not be reasonably inferred.
But respectfully, Your Honor, that's not supported by the record. At page 204, the defense attorney states in closing argument, the only issue in this case is whether Mr. Clark intended to spit water on Deputy Shiflett. That was the only issue in the case, was whether this was an accident. The entire theory of the case throughout this prosecution was that Mr. Shiflett had choked on that water. The defendant, he was taking medication, the officer handed him a Dixie cup full of water, and the theory of the case by the defense was that he choked on that water and he accidentally spat, you know, he kind of hacked and spewed the water out. The theory of the case wasn't that it was done without a intent to do bodily harm. The theory of the case was that it was an accident. The defense did not have to give up their theory of the case. And the time to object here, you know, the 5818 rule is that it must be a specific and timely objection, time for the court to do something about it. And I believe that the court could have, you know, this was still in the bosom of the court still could have, you know, fixed it. But the time really to object to this was at the motion in limine, when the court said, oh, we're going on a battery defense. Hepatitis C is irrelevant because the Commonwealth doesn't have to prove up intent to do bodily harm. And the court was willing to fix it. The court said, okay, if you want to hold the Commonwealth to their proof on assault, we're going to reopen it. We're going to reopen the evidence so the Commonwealth can prove up assault. The court never reached the issue of whether the hepatitis C was overly prejudicial compared to its probative value. That just was never reached.
So your suggestion is, assuming for the sake of discussion,
yes,
that this alternative that you're discussing was available to the defendant, what he should have done is made a record to show why and how the trial court erred in reconsidering its motion in limine.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. I think that, you know, it was a tactical decision, as the court indicated earlier. You know, and I'm not saying it was an easy tactical decision. I think it was a hard tactical decision that the defendant made on the fly, you know, as necessary, you know, in the exigencies of trial practice. I'm not saying it was an easy decision, but it was a tactical decision, and the tactical decision was to, no matter what, keep hepatitis C out of the guilt phase. And that's the choice that the defendant made, and the defendant cannot now complain about that on appeal because the defendant did not make a record.
You would suggest it's approbating and reprobating.
Yes, it is approbating and reprobating. The defendant chose to have the benefit of the motion in limine and has now decided that didn't work out as well as planned.
Being very judicious.
and for those reasons, Your Honor, the Commonwealth would ask that the conviction be affirmed. And if the court has any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you very much,
Your
Honor.
Thank you. Counsel, you have about 2.5 minutes left.
Your Honor, if I could just first reference the fact that the Commonwealth allegedly elected to proceed under a battery theory, that is simply not supported. A Commonwealth cannot just make a representation to the court without making a formal motion to amend the indictment. The indictment is what is the charging document. The Commonwealth is in charge of that. They preside over grand jury. They're the ones who seek the charges.
What does the indictment say?
The assault and battery.
Which is, in my view, a misnomer that's been created in the law forever, because those are, as I understand it, back when I went to law school in the olden days, those are two separate theories of liability.
Well, that's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And I would point to the Commonwealth-cited case of Parrish. In that, the Parrish court in this court in Parrish says the crime of assault and the crime of battery are independent criminal acts, although they are linked in Code 18257. So Parrish, this court recognized that while they are two separate acts, 18257 links them together. And then if you further go on, Your Honor, it states once again, one cannot be convicted of an assault and battery without an intention to do bodily harm, either an actual intention or an intention imputed by law. And I will concede the point that the sense that that intent may be imputed if the touching is done in a rude, angry, insulting language. That's what this court says.
But couldn't it be suggested that in that case that you cite, that the term assault and battery was used with some degree of imprecision? It should have been making reference to a battery as opposed to an assault and battery.
No, Your Honor, because I think Parrish specifically, the court addresses that the intention from the assault, the intention to inflict bodily harm, has to then come on with the battery. A battery is simply not just the touching. If it is charged as assault and battery, you have to also have that intent to do bodily harm. And I point the court once again to the statute. The statute reads assault and battery. Then you go down one subsection in D, it says battery. E says battery. It doesn't mention anything about assault. But Parrish makes it very clear, and it's a 2010 decision by this court, that if you charge assault and battery, you must have that element of intent to do bodily harm coupled with the touching. It's not simply just the touching done in an angry, rude, or insulting manner. I would further point out to the court that this court should take no merit in what my argument was at closing, because at that point, the issue was done. The court had already told us, if you mention it, we're going to bring it back up. So I was hamstrung at closing to say that I had to argue in a very specific way.
That's the first time I'm grinning, because that's the first time I've ever heard a lawyer say, ignore what I said before. I'm saying the good stuff right now.
Well, and I think the court has to understand the situation. The judge specifically called counsel up as the jury was being seated and they had the discussion. Trial court called co-counsel unprofessional. We are in the middle of a trial, and then he makes us choose between these two rights, and then I have to be very specific and deliberate in the words that I choose at closing, because heaven forbid I say something incorrect and then the trial court says, well, you opened the door and now they get to say this, even though there's no evidence to suggest it otherwise, or even suggest there's a causal relationship one way or the other.
All right, counsel, the case is submitted. That completes the docket for today. We'll come down and